Hello and welcome to the Transmedia Podcast. This is me, Robert Pratton, and you can find me online as Rob Pratton on Twitter. And it's great to finally be back. I know we've been away for quite a long time, at least the English podcasts have been. And I'm delighted to have with me today Mike Quackenbush, who's the founder of Chikara. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So Mike, it was somebody on Twitter that recommended that I take a look at what you've been doing. And I think a lot of our viewers, listeners, won't be familiar with what Chikara is. So why don't we start with that?
Certainly. Chikara is perhaps best described as a comic book come to life that exists in the performance genre best known as professional wrestling. So I always like to tell people or draw the analogy to comic books because that is so much closer to the aesthetic we create than what I guess people probably imagine when they first hear the phrase professional wrestling. So Chikara, which has existed for 12 years now, recently embarked on, I'd like to think, a very ambitious story that began to incorporate lots of transmedia elements as it went along, and I'm betting that's probably what brought us to your attention.
Yeah, exactly, because, like, so I'm familiar with, like, WWF, and I'm familiar with some of the sort of wrestling we have in the UK. I don't know what the sort of league or the name is for that. And so I'm used to the wrestlers having certain characters, but I've never heard of the term Chikara, and I've never seen it, you know, taken to the sort of the depths that you guys have gone with it.
Well, thank you. And incidentally, I'm a tremendous, not only admirer, but a practitioner of what we think of as the classical British style that was made popular on the World of Sport wrestling program through the 1970s and 80s.
Oh, well.
So I don't know if you were a follower during the heyday of, I'm trying to think of, some of the biggest stars of that era were Big Daddy and Mick McManus.
Yeah, Big Daddy, exactly.
Jackie Palo. But there were some incredibly elegant wrestlers that were possessed of tremendous ring finesse, like Johnny Saint, Johnny Kidd, Mike Flash Jordan, Steve Gray. And these are some of the very finest technical wrestlers of all time. And they're all British. And they've had a tremendous influence on our style. So I might actually be more familiar with them than I am with some of their American counterparts. But we exist on a much smaller scale than Vince McMahon's operation, World Wrestling Entertainment, or any of the global-type brands. But it is, of course, our interest to see if we can't attract a wider audience, because what we make, I believe, is the kind of thing a lot of fans would genuinely enjoy. But there's a certain stigma that comes with professional wrestling that can be difficult to overcome. And we're working very hard to show people that this is something that does not insult your intelligence. It doesn't take its audience for granted or regard them with any level of contempt, and that we're trying to really challenge them in new ways. And that speaks a little bit to, I think, a divergence that's happening right now, Rob, in this way. There is two types of wrestling fan. One of them, I think, wants professional wrestling, or just wrestling in general, maybe combat sports as a general thing, to be as real as it can be, which is things like UFC or mixed martial arts or cage fighting. And I'm sure that's entirely viable. It's very profitable. UFC is a very profitable company. But what intrigues me is the other side of this divergence, which is the fact that for a while, I think wrestling was reluctant to embrace the fact that it exists in a fictional space. And that is true of what we do. Everything can be, when it needs to be, very neatly predetermined. And we could be embarrassed of that or ashamed of what we are, or we can celebrate the fact that we exist in this fictional space and start to explore the possibilities when you really do embrace the idea that this is a fictional narrative and that the fans are not oblivious to this. It's not as if they support us in spite of what we are. They support us for exactly what we are. And it's very exciting to me to try and take that as far afield as we can possibly get in the opposite direction of what comes to mind when I think generally of combat sports.
I think for me, like the cage fighting, or that's a bit too violent. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's, and so if I had young kids, I think I would be more inclined to sit, like I remember when, you know, when I was younger, we'd sit down to watch like Big Daddy or Mick McManus or someone, and you'd sit down with your folks, and you kind of, you know, it was a bit violent, but you kind of felt like it was a bit pretend, like there wasn't blood and people, you know, it wasn't violent, whatever, it was sort of like combat, you know, stuff. And is that true of the sort of wrestling that you guys do?
We do. We work very, very hard to make it acceptable to the entire family. Because when wrestling really spoke to me in my youth, it was the characters and the stories which grabbed my attention, not the physical mechanics of wrestling holds. Right. And I think that's what appeals to people of all ages, are characters they can relate to, stories that they can become invested in. And so I want that to be acceptable to everyone, young and old, regardless of their education or their income or their race or any of those types of things. I want it to be as acceptable to all audiences as we can possibly make it. Having said that, though, I never want to have to create a type of wrestling that appeals to the lowest common denominator so that we attract a broader base. That's not particularly appealing to me. And I think there is a lot of wrestling out there that is written that way. It's crafted to be for the lowest common denominator. And what I like about what we make is our audience enjoys being challenged. And I want to tell you a little bit about some of the narrative that's going on recently and the ways in which we were able to, through using transmedia elements or things that we borrowed from alternate reality gaming, to engage fans.
Tell me, like, because I saw on the website that if there's someone out there that's a new wrestler, you will actually build a character for them from the bottom up. So they get, like, the history and the backstory and everything, as well as the costume design. Mm-hmm. So how do you – presumably there is a universe of these characters, and, you know, you decide, you know, where these new characters ought to fit. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an ever-expanding cast, and right now it's probably as large as it's been in our 12-year history. There's over 80 characters. So a universe that large, someone's got to be minding the corners of that universe, or it does get a bit unwieldy, Rob.
And do they divide into, like, goodies and baddies, or, how do they divide up?
Very much so. And that part of it really speaks to our comic book influence. There's a fairly clear division between heroes and villains. I'm very attracted to the idea of folks in outlandish costumes performing superhuman feats. That speaks directly to my love of the comic book genre. And I think in this day and age, too, where superhero movies are as popular as they are, this thing, when I was growing up anyway, to be a comic book fan was indicative of nerd culture, but now it's really mainstream. Superheroes are everywhere. You know, you can't walk down the street without seeing a Batman shirt or something like that. I do like to give those types of designations to our characters, especially now. We're coming out of doing some very dark storytelling that drew a lot of allusions to a mid-80s work by the author Alan Moore called Watchmen, which is a landmark in the comic book industry for its deconstruction of the superhero medium at large and for the way it really challenged some of the just accepted concepts that that were a little weird in all of comic bookdom. That was a very exciting thing for me to experience, to watch the way he went about attacking something, and did it in a very loving way. He didn't do it as an antagonist, so to speak, or I don't believe he did. I don't know Alan Moore. it seemed to be done as a way of saying, can we help this medium to grow up a little bit? And that's a very exciting concept to me. So I tried to the best of my ability, take a bit of the spirit of that and incorporate it into the fictional universe where I and about 80 other characters happen to exist. That's a very intriguing thing. Certainly things along the way that informed what we've embarked on, and it was really a multiple-year arc, were things like the viral marketing campaigns for films like The Dark Knight or for Trent Reznor's album Year Zero. And some other viral marketing type things that were just, to me, mind-boggling. I was really just sort of beginning to explore that and realize there is a universe out there of this type of material, and more so, there are even firms out there that you could retain to develop that type of marketing for you. You could pay a really high dollar figure and have somebody initiate and execute a viral campaign on your behalf.
I thought you were going to say execute a baddie to come out and so because what so like I think our listeners will be familiar with the idea that there's a story world and these characters are in there, but I think it's quite interesting that you've actually got an arc. So instead of presumably each of these wrestling bouts being just a kind of isolated event, they are actually some kind of chapter or a beat in this larger sort of story.
You're exactly right. So I think you'll see, in the context of a wrestling match itself, you'll see an establishment of characters. You'll see one character endure a conflict, and then a climax happens. Generally speaking, it doesn't make sense in front of a live audience to drift off into anticlimax. So usually you see that done in three acts, and I just mean that as opposed to something like a five-act structure. But you'll also see that in the larger work as well. And that's something that we've been telling for a couple of years. And I'll summarize a little bit of that story for you now. What had happened in our storytelling was that our modest company was, in storyline, acquired by a giant conglomerate. They were called the Teeter Conglomerate.
And this is a fictional conglomerate.
That's right. So along the way, it was very important that, of course, we needed to build the websites for these things, that you had to be able to email the people that are listed on the website as working there, and they had to be able to respond to you. It had to feel very real, even though, of course, this is a fictional construct. Even before that was put in place, we had started a blog by a supposed conspiracy theorist who had to function later in the story as a whistleblower type character. So those elements, like just that conspiracy theory blog, for example, we started building that maybe 5 or 6 years before we needed it, so that it could appear to be something real, that this guy regularly published his findings and people could follow him. They could read this blog if they were intrigued by his theories about UFOs or government cover-ups or things of that nature. But those things, of course, as you know, and as folks out there really familiar with the way those types of things must be done to seem authentic to the viewer, a lot of front-loading goes into making all of those elements, which typically is not part of what we do in the pro wrestling sphere. So that was a very exciting thing. Ultimately, it came to light that this conglomerate had their fingers in a lot of dirty deeds. And rather than risk exposure, they started to cut ties and they started to shut down some of their operations, including our wrestling organization, which to the world at large appeared to go dark for a period of 8 months. All of our live events were canceled. One of them, which was streaming out live, the stream was abruptly interrupted by the conglomerate's paramilitary force. During that, all of our upcoming tour dates were canceled and everything else. It appeared as if the story had come to an end. But in that interim, using a variety of mediums and a variety of tools that we could use, whether it was leaking a choice piece of video to a fan through an anonymous Dropbox account, for example, a post that might appear on Tumblr, there was, just as an example, an eBay auction to get rid of some of the company's assets, and the people that acquired them inside, there was a coded message for them. all of these things began to build momentum to a couple of guerrilla-style events, one of which was if people were able to decipher things, they discovered where these coordinates led them on a certain date and time, they showed up in the middle of a public park in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to see our ring erected, and a guerrilla event took place out in the middle of a public park, which strangely enough, climaxed in one of our fans being abducted by a security force. This triggered a scavenger hunt that encompassed an entire city and ate up an entire day as our fans were out there trying to find incriminating documents against this conglomeration, and they succeeded. And in their frustration, the conglomerate decided to divest themselves of Chikara, and we were ultimately auctioned off to the highest bidder. This opens up a world of new stories that we're able to tell. Very out-of-the-box type stuff for the world of pro wrestling. And certainly along the way, I think we've discovered that there are some pro wrestling fans that are not intrigued by this type of story. This doesn't really engage them. Their primary focus is only on what occurs in the ring. I certainly appreciate that. But there are folks that are very intrigued by the characters. They want to see where they go. They want to see what happens. They've made an emotional investment in the characters, and they want to see their arc through to its completion. They want to know will these guys be able to come back together? Can they reunite? Can they overcome these things in front of them, especially when they have a fan base that is as engaged and as activated as ours has been throughout the arc of this? So that element of it's been very rewarding.
So is it a bit, it sounds a bit scary actually going dark for 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? How did you make that decision? What, were you not a bit worried? Or?
Yes, it came with all the obvious risks. Financially, it was extremely risky. There was the risk that the fan base would not detect the greater narrative at work and really think, they're closed, that's the end, goodbye.
Right.
So it was not without its risks, but we have, for 12 years, the company Chikara has existed at roughly the same level. And I'll characterize it to you in this way. Chikara does not generate enough revenue to pay one single man a living wage.
Right.
So we could continue on forever and ever, repeating the same types of things that we've always done, taking roughly the same level of risks, et cetera, et cetera. And the odds that things would escalate for us are, But it felt like if we were to really commit to this idea 100%, granted it is very, very risky, and we see it through to its conclusion, we come out the other side, and we create a story unlike anything that's ever been told in our performance art genre before, perhaps we can attract a new fan base that says, I'm really intrigued to see what these guys do next. Or, you know, even if in hindsight they only discover the story, they say, they really did this, that the company went dark for this number of months and it climaxed in this way and all these other things. I'd like to know more about it. And we can only hope, and I think the months ahead are really going to bear this out, whether or not we were successful in attracting a new type of fan to the type of fiction that we create, or if we failed.
Wow, that's really good. And, like, have you been able to monitor sort of fan conversations? Is there like a fan forum or a Facebook place where they hang out?
Indeed there is. So Chikara101.com is the great entry point, especially for folks that are new, because, one, we have a really wonderful, inviting, and inclusive fan base. I'm so delighted that they're not sort of off-putting to the newbies. They don't like wield an experience over them like, well, I've been here longer than you or anything right. like that. It's a really inviting community, which is terrific. That's a great entry point, and that's where a lot of the conversation was centered, because we did use so many various means, like for example, sending out choice video clues via Dropbox. Well, if they didn't all get together somewhere to discuss, I got this clue, and I got this piece, and I think this piece connects to this one, part of it would have been lost. So that sense of community was really important. Certainly, there were those within our industry, I think, that were very critical of the decisions that we were making, saying, this is a surefire way to run fans off. However, our numbers would seem to contradict that. For example, in the period of time, 8 to 9 months that our company appeared to be dark, 1,000 new people joined our fan forum. several thousand new ones followed us on Twitter during a period of time that we tweeted only once in 8 months. Part of the story, part of our narrative, was told in a web series that was released to YouTube. And this series of 20 videos collectively been watched more than 500,000 times. So I would argue that perhaps some previous fans did in fact disengage, but I think we were successful in finding a new audience, or perhaps even engaging the existing audience at a greater level than ever before.
Well, that's really fabulous, actually.
That's well,
really
thanks.
Good. And so, I mean, how did you go about planning all of this? Did you have like a big schedule of activities for that 8 months, or did you sort of build it on the fly as you saw reactions coming in?
A combination thereof. So I had a really meticulously detailed schedule of every single day, or every other day maybe, you know, as the schedule demanded. But one thing I was really ill prepared for was there was a much greater need for immediacy, to be reactive than I had originally anticipated, because this was our first time diving into this pool, Rob. So initially, for example, we thought we're going to have a period right after the apparent shutdown where we're going to go to complete radio silence. We want to make it as effective as possible. Nobody's, You email, nobody's answering. You call, nobody's there. And the period of time that we'd originally figured that was going to go, we realized this is far too much. People require some level of communication. They need a hint. They need a clue. They need something to start to point them in the right direction, because in this day and age, with the rapidity of the internet and everything else, people are demanding the media. They're demanding the content delivered more quickly than ever before. So some parts of that schedule really had to be thrown out the window because it was not drafted with that sense of immediacy to it. I really underestimated how impatient people would be for the next bit. They would want the next chunk to come to them right away so they could pore over it and analyze it and decipher it and all those fun things. So that had to start to happen on the fly. Some of, especially the things related to the alternate reality game elements of it, really did begin to develop on the fly because I was woefully unprepared for how demanding it would be to do it. It gives me an enormous respect for the folks that are able to engineer and execute those things flawlessly, because doing something like that is a full-time job unto itself.
Yeah, exactly. It can be. And the YouTube videos, were they all scripted, or what's in them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've been compiled. So if this has intrigued you, a great place to watch them from the beginning through to the end as they were presented is at theashesofchikara.com. So they're all right there, including a new bit that was just released this morning, actually. I'm not sure when this will air. But that is a giant part of the narrative, is what's told in those 20 videos. And, those were I can put it to you this way. It was akin to making a movie on a budget of zero.
Yeah.
The quality, I think, that we not only demanded of ourselves, but that the audience wanted for something as ambitious as this really required us to deliver at a level that we never had before. So we really did have to challenge ourselves. And even though there's other parts of the story that we've withheld, we've not yet shown them, a good portion of it was given away on YouTube, because it was really important that the audience see the story at work. It was not just enough to, it's like this phenomenon. We would, in releasing a new bit of information, it was like going to the top of a fish tank with the food after the fish had not eaten, and you put just one or two flakes, and everyone rushes up to try and get to those flakes first of all. We realized that it really wasn't coming out. The content wasn't frequent enough. It wasn't meaty enough at times. And so in that regard, we had to be reactive to the needs of the audience. And, all right, we need to step this up. This needs to be bigger. This needs to be longer. We need to tell more of this, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. So you were shooting the videos as you went. You didn't, like, shoot them all back to back and then...
That would have made a lot of sense, Rob. That would have made a whole lot of sense. But no. No, we thought, why do it like that?
Well, it gave you flexibility, so that's quite good.
That's the silver lining. I'm glad you identified it for me.
And did the what was the relationship with the wrestlers during this time? Were they, up for it? How did they manage their sort of individual relationships with the fans in the context of the story and everything?
That was a real challenge that I was not very well prepared for, because each of these characters, you could interact with them on Twitter. And when you have a character base as large as ours, to try and account for how every single interaction is going to go, it just became impossible.
I can imagine.
There wasn't a day that didn't go by that someone didn't reach out to me and say, someone is asking me this right now on Twitter or in some other, fairly immediate forum about our story. And what is my character's response in this moment? That was like a daily thing. For a very long period of time. I have a real appreciation now for why most ARG-type things have a very finite timeline, and that timeline is usually closer to 3 or 4 weeks, because trying to maintain that for the number of months we did has been exhausting.
So each of the wrestlers has their own Twitter account, so it's their responsibility to maintain that and stay in character.
Mm-hmm, that's right. So, of course, as you can imagine, that comes with its own set of challenges. And during this period, speaking just of the narrative here, after Chikara appeared to go dark, all of our characters were scattered into these smaller satellite organizations. And a different narrative emerged there, where a group of villains from our past began to come together in the absence of Chikara proper to oppose them, and they began to sink these figurative lifeboats. They began to destroy these other wrestling companies. So while many of the other wrestlers were able to fill up their schedule doing some of these other ones, in that period where we appeared to be doing nothing, we actually made 60 live events. It was important to keep the wrestlers very busy so that their calendars weren't blank. But returning to your earlier point, I'm certain, despite the fact that when we all get together in a group, everybody does seem to be on the same page, and we all, generally speaking, we're looking to advance the pro wrestling art form in the same way. I have no doubt that along the way, some of the guys must have been like, is there really going to be a reward at the end of this worthy of the risk we're taking?
Right. Yeah, I can imagine they might ask that. But, I mean, it sounds like, like you say, you've kept them busy somehow in these other kind of side stories. Like, you kind of thought through that issue, like, we need to keep these guys earning. Because presumably they take, like a percentage of the box office or something like that when they're fighting. Is that how it works?
Mm-hmm. You're right. So each of them, if they depend on making a certain amount of income each month from wrestling, I think it would have gone a very different way if I'd said, and by the way, there'll be no work for the next 8 or 9 months.
Okay.
So I think, is the expression, it would have gone pear-shaped? Is that appropriate?
Yeah, exactly.
Is that an appropriate expression?
It is, yeah. They would have been less appreciative, less willing to. So that's pretty interesting. And are they all on a mailing list? So as the kind of plot twists sort of develop, you could sort of email them all out to say, this is the current status of everything. You got to be
right. It was
this way,
certainly, because there were times when, if a video would come out that had a cliffhanger ending, in the 7 days before or whatever the gap might have been. Initially, the videos were only coming once a month. Then they became biweekly. Then they were coming weekly, and at the end, they were coming daily, so that people could really feel the escalation and the dramatic tension. Because there was the narrative being told on YouTube through our Ashes videos, but there was also the live narrative. These other wrestling companies are being destroyed by an indomitable force of villains. And then, of course, there were also the interactivity elements that were going on with our fan base. These three narratives had to converge at exactly the right time, and we really needed to convey that heightening tension to the audience. So that was one method that we used for that, was that the videos began to come much more frequently. The information started to come out much more frequently. So they went from knowing, oh, I only discuss this on Mondays when the new video publishes, to I'm talking about this every single day. And in that way, it did seem to climax very effectively.
That's really good. And you was able to keep the story on track, because sometimes people worry that when they engage the fans, that the fans might go off in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that you didn't have that problem.
Oh, I'm really, really fortunate that I work with this wonderful crew of creative people that I think really understood how desperately this had to stay on the rails. Especially when you're creating that volume of content with that frequency, it's so easy to be, we just didn't get the video done. Or at least in my, as I alluded to, when you're making a movie on $0, it's really hard to say, well, you're not going to get paid. I could say, I'm not going to bring you that ham sandwich. But luckily, everyone really made a terrific investment into this. And they really believed what I believe. And that is that we can move the pro wrestling performance art genre forward. We do not need to just keep repeating the same tropes or sometimes making the same mistakes. And I would much rather, as a creator, go out and later regret something that I did try versus regretting something I was too afraid to try. There was ample reason not to attempt something like this, a story that risks the fan base being gone, that puts us in a bad way financially, to rely on things, and as I'm sure you come across this, especially given what you do, there are people that really, they struggle to see the correlation sometimes between viral marketing and what the end result can be with fans. Those are all sometimes very nebulous or difficult to wrap your brain around concepts, and I would never want to look back and say, well, that would have been really something special if we just had the courage to try. I would much rather we try it and go out and fail and say, well, at least we can learn from our mistake.
That's really good. And you feel like you've got a platform now, so you've got stories. How far do the stories that are currently untold stretch into the future now?
Fortunately for us, we've got a minimum of another year or two of stories that spring from this, at a minimum. And what's great about our narrative, I think, is that they always connect. There's never really a disconnect. We never push the reset button. There's no reason to ever discard the previous continuity. It does kind of flow together and tell one continuous narrative. So if you were so possessed, you could go back and start watching in February of 2005 our DVDs and everything else and follow one continuous story right up to and including now. So that again just speaks to my love of the comic book medium. I like that idea of following across the long term arcs of characters. There are some that I just want to pop in every once and again and see, and that's what I love about movies or sometimes short-form television programs. I just want to spend a little bit of time with these characters, but I also appreciate the types of narratives that allow me to follow a character across the long term.
And could, like, as a fan, could I go back to all the material which is sort of now sort of archived, I guess, online, mm-hmm. and just pick out the bits for the particular character that I like? Or, you know, is that possible? Do all 80 characters get a fair sort of shake of the story during that period?
No. Certainly some are more at the forefront and some are more supporting players. I had a really interesting conversation as this was about to launch with a fellow named Larry Hama. And Larry, in the 1980s, reinvented the G.I. Joe franchise. G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, became a very popular cartoon series and an action figure line and a comic book and everything else based on what Larry did in the 1980s. And that universe contains well over 100 characters. And I was able to consult him for just a bit of advice right as we were about to embark on this part of the story, because I felt like I have a really unwieldy volume of characters, and I don't know what to do with some of them. And I said to Larry, I said, when you had to manage this really bulky G.I. Joe universe that had all these characters in it, how did you keep them all in play? And he said, first of all, not everyone can be a main character. You'll drive yourself nuts if you try to do that. You know, you can focus only on this, a set of characters like this at any one time. And then you just kind of need to rotate them away so someone else can take center stage. And you need to sort of designate, all right, these characters are going to have very important complete arcs that the audience needs to see. And then maybe there's only some partial arcs back here for some of the supporting players. We don't want to ignore them, but we can't. There just isn't sufficient spotlight to have that many characters front and center at all times. And hearing that from him was a great relief to me, because I was really agonizing over the fact that we had an enormous number of characters, and it did not seem like each of them would be serviced equally. Luckily, I think my crew is of the right mindset, where they understand that eventually everyone does get their turn. It can be difficult at times to be patient, but I think our track record has proven to the cast and crew over the years that eventually everyone does get their turn, even if it doesn't happen to be right this moment. Which is terrific, because as I mentioned, it's simply impossible, I think, to tell a story like that where your focus is on so many characters equally all at once.
Yeah, exactly. And does 80 characters mean 80 wrestlers, or do some wrestlers play more than one character?
Well, there are not quite 80 wrestlers, but some of these characters, Rob, are non-wrestling characters. They might be might be a referee. It might be an announcer. It might be someone that functions in a non-wrestling capacity.
There might
be 8 or 10 of those, but the vast majority of them are individual, unique wrestling characters. But virtually everyone, I felt like this has to encompass the whole universe. It can't be everybody except for these two guys. For it to have the stakes this type of story required, everyone had to be in jeopardy. It was not enough that one hero character was in jeopardy, or just this group of protagonists were in jeopardy, but literally everyone was jeopardized by this. And it went back to this discussion I had a few years ago. As a storyteller, you're always looking for ways to take the character that the audience cares about the most and put them in a conflict where the stakes are high so that the audience makes the right investment. and we had this conversation internally. Which single character of ours is the one that the audience is the most fond of? Who do they care the most about? And after debating that for quite a while, what we realized was it's the ensemble. It's everybody. What? They like seeing everybody all together. Or to give it maybe a more modern analogy, they care more about the Avengers than they do any single one member of that team. And then the challenge became, well, how do you put everybody in jeopardy all at once? How do you make the stakes very, very high and very, very real for everybody all at once? And that was one of the germination points for the whole story.
Really good. And so the alternate reality game's over now. The business is sort of back in business. It's not dark any longer.
Correct.
Are you? What does it mean for you in terms of the production schedule now? I mean, is it now back to business as it was, holding sort of regular bouts and telling the story as you always did, or have you sort of doubled your workload now going forward?
I feel like you're looking right at my daily planner when you say that. So it is a little bit back to business as usual, which does come as a relief to me, because as a creature of habit, for everything I did on a daily basis to be radically different for the last 8 or 9 months was quite an adjustment for me to make. But I think now that we've started to explore this, to really get out there and test the waters with some incredibly fun material that does, I think we've shown, it can work in our type of fictional storytelling. What intrigues me most is, how can we do this again? Where can we find, maybe not, for example, it may not necessarily be a physical scavenger hunt, but taking other concepts from those types of experiences where I really am giving some agency to the fans to be able to dictate the direction of the story. Like this, for example, at the climax of the scavenger hunt, one of our fans really held in their hands the incriminating documents that were needed to damage this conglomerate. And they had the choice. I can either surrender this to this party or I can give it to this party. That decision was entirely in their hands, independent of us to influence, which can be a very, how do I want to put that?
Nerve-wracking.
Yes, that's the exact word. Nerve-wracking experience. But what they really proved to us, the fans were, they said, we want to play with you. There was a time in wrestling where I think guys used to get together and think, like, we're putting one over on our fan base. They don't realize that the outcomes are predetermined or these kinds of things. And they were having a bit of a laugh at the expense of our paying customers. And I think, fortunately for us, that is an obsolete idea. Right. And that to regard your audience with that type of contempt is quite dangerous, in my opinion. I like the fact that our audience knows we come not to play in front of you necessarily, but that we come to play with you. And finding ways, whether it's using other elements of transmedia, or like that example from very specifically an alternate reality game, where we show them, we really do want to play with you. If we can, we want to find ways to extend agency to you so that you're an active participant in our universe. I think that speaks to what people want from their entertainment experiences in the here and now. And I don't want to be afraid to go out and explore that, even if it does mean at times taking tremendous risks, doing it in the face of criticism, and on occasion, failing miserably.
I mean, what does it mean for the outcome of the bouts that are going to come up now? I mean, does that mean that, you know, the fans know or the wrestlers know, like, what the outcome will be? Like, who's going to win, who's going to lose?
No, I think that element will remain the same. You never really know that part of it. There's an evergreen intrigue to that. But now we have this enormous force of villains on stage, assembled against a recently reunited team of protagonists. And I think for what we're going to be doing in our upcoming, which we're calling our 14th season as we're about to start on May 25th, I think the stage has been as adequately set as we could possibly make it for the battles that are to come and for the story to continue to play out. Because, as I said, there is a lot more story. There are a lot of narrative loose ends. What happened to this character, or what made this character decide to do that? And we really owe it to our audience to try and give them as many of those answers as possible so that we don't disappoint their expectation.
And where can people see the live events?
Well, our next live event, which is May 25th, 2014, it's going to be taking place in Easton, Pennsylvania. But if for some reason you're on the other side of the Atlantic or wherever you might be, we may have something up our sleeve which we're going to announce in the very near future, that will make it available and accessible for you to experience live as well, because we really do want as many people as possible to be able to enjoy it in a timely fashion. I think that live quotient, the extra verve that that adds to it, being able to see it as it's unfolding in real time, there's really no substitute for that. And especially for the folks that have only just discovered us very, very recently, we want them to be able to engage as fully as possible. So for more information about that, whether you're interested in buying tickets to the live event, or if you want to read a brief story recap, our recently relaunched website is ChikaraPro.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We're also at ChikaraPro there, where new information comes out. Or, as I mentioned before, those videos have been compiled in sequence for you to watch. That's at theashesofchikara.com.
I'll put them in the sort of show notes, as they say, so people can click through. And I think what's really interesting is that, you know, when we think of the 70s or whenever it was that I would have been watching the wrestling on TV, then there was only one way to watch wrestling. But now you can go direct to the fans. You can set up your own channel, your own media sort of empire in a way, and just go directly to them. I think that's quite empowering. That's really interesting.
Yes, I like the fact that there are ways now to watch it on your mobile device. Well, certainly I have fond memories of gathering around the television set and watching wrestling with friends. There are tons of other ways that you can experience it, and especially through this recent exploration that we did in our 13th season with this very unusual story of ours, I do like this type of inversion. For example, one thing that happened during our story was that this paramilitary force that worked for the Teeter conglomerate, they went to fans' houses in the greater Philadelphia market to threaten them in person. And I don't want to discuss the legality of that with you, Rob, but you know, there was a time when the way you interacted with wrestling was you turned it on and you watched it on a flat screen, you had a static experience, and you turned it back off. And the experience where characters from the wrestling story ring your doorbell and hand you a business card or what have you is a radically different experience. That's the story coming to you, not you coming to the story to engage it and then turn it back off, but the story coming to find you. And those types of things really excite me about the future of my performance art, because I want to see professional wrestling grow in all kinds of new ways, not just repeat the familiar over and over again, although that's always fine to go back and re-experience. But I'm most intrigued by what lies ahead by continuing to explore concepts like these.
Mike, that's fabulous. I'm really pleased to have had you on the podcast. We've got lots of places for people to explore. What if you a parting word to the audience? Where should they go, and what should they have in mind?
Well, I think there are probably some folks that tuned in today that, if asked, are you a professional wrestling fan, they would not raise their hand. But I think you might be pleasantly surprised, if you wanted to come join us over in the Chikara sphere, that this defies what your preconceived notion of professional wrestling might be, and we might draw you in if you're willing to give us a chance. So I sincerely hope that maybe some folks are intrigued and they want to jump over, whether it's to check out the videos in hindsight or to see the new things which are rolling out. And at this point, really, is virtually every day something new is coming out. And I'll sum it up in this way for you. I believe, first and foremost, that professional wrestling should be fun. And that's why my crew and I make it for everyone. And I realize that rhymed. So
that's really good. Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.